Good morning, everyone, and welcome to this session, the IFRS Insurance ED, a more useful lens on risk business for investment management. Each of our three speakers today are members of the Institute's International Accounting Standards Committee, and each of them was involved in preparing the Institute's response to the International Accounting Standard Board's exposure draft on an insurance accounting standard. So a brief one on each of them. Grant convenes that Actuaries Institute International Accounting Standards Committee and has been an active participant in the ongoing dialogue with the International Australian Accounting Standards Setters around the development of the insurance accounting standards since 2006. He led the development of those Institute responses to the EDs in 2007 discussion paper, the 2010 and 2013 exposure draft, and he has also participated in the ISB field testing on their proposals. Brendan Council is a director in EY's Financial Services actuarial practice based in Sydney. He's been actively involved in the development of the new accounting standard for insurance contracts. So in addition to his work with the Institute, he's also a member of EY's Global Reporting Standards Network, in particular focused on the ISB's deliberations on the IFRS 4 and IFRS 9 projects. And last is Hua Bui. Hua is a partner at KPMG since 2004 and leads KPMG's life insurance actuarial practice. Prior to joining KPMG, she held senior actuarial roles at ACNL, AXA and TAL. In addition to her work with the Institute of Actuaries, she's also been part of KPMG's global network in responding to the international accounting standards. She's a frequent presenter at the Institute of Actuaries forums, including presenting on risk margins for life insurance at the 2008 Financial Services Forum. So we've got about 30 minutes of presentation and hopefully 20 minutes for questions. So with that, I'll hand over to Grant.
Thank you. So the long journey continues, as you probably picked up. This has been a topic we've been ongoing and developing for an awful long time, but I'm hoping that I may just get to retirement before it, but I'm not sure about that one. Anyway, to open up, I'll talk briefly, and then technology still challenges me at times. Though I'm still doing better than my son who's doing a networking degree. I still keep my network at home going, he can't. Anyway, we're basically going to go through the key IFRS changes from business. Hopefully take about 5 minutes, it'll be me talking. Then we're going to go through a number of numerical outworkings to kind of show you the, bring out really the dynamics of what these things are actually doing and the proposals are doing around the three key pieces of business. And then we go into a session around how does it affect you in your business, and then a conclusion and discussion. And the idea is to really get to the time, so we've got about at least 20 minutes for discussion, which I'm sure should open up out of what this is showing us. It's not all locked down. The ISB is still debating stuff, but I think most of the stuff in this space is really pretty well locked down and not likely to move too much, apart from the issue around whether or not if you've got can unbundle riders sitting on IL business, etc. Looks like that's going to be an interesting one for us. But for most people, otherwise, the rest of it is pretty locked down, so you can really start thinking about what this may mean for you when this actually comes to pass. So the key changes is basically acquisition costs now exclude overheads, so you can't DAC those parts, and that probably reduces the amount you can DAC if you're actually able to continue to do DACing, which we'll talk about later for other reasons. Significantly, depending on your view of overheads. Contract boundary rules, this is a really big change, which we flagged way back in the 2010 ED, which came about to keep the health insurers actually solvent under IFRS. And basically that means that yearly renewable premium business basically is going to be a short-term contract. Unless you can actually fully reprice the contract at a portfolio level. And effectively, to get out of that, if you really want to get back your business back under long-term, you either have to have some level of guarantees or semi-guarantees around your premium rates, or alternatively, basically, if you're writing level-term business, that will get you back into there. So if you're deciding you really want to be writing more level-term versus step, that'll change how your measurement and the contract boundaries fairly substantially. And now on transition, the other big change is effectively on short-term business, you're basically to GI accounting, so your DAC disappears pretty well. You can hold a DAC for the remainder of the contract boundary, which is out to the balance of the year, to the next renewal, but it probably ain't worth the time and effort to actually set and manage one for the small amount of accounting benefit you're going to get out of it, apart from the complexity. And otherwise, if it's long-term, then you'll have to write off part of the DAC relating to the overhead piece that drops out, and otherwise, and restate your profit margins accordingly, so you get some uplift out of the other side of it. This actually is here to really bring a quick view of how the pieces there in the two approaches. Basically, if you're into short-term contracts, you're really able to use the simplified approach, really think GIN, premium style accounting, really. And it is really much like the existing GI accounting regime, including risk margins, etc. Alternatively, you're in the building block where you really think it's basically MOS, with basically you now got a variation, which is effectively what was your profit margin has now been split up into a contractual service margin, which is now fully unlocked. The ISB have basically bought all the submissions coming out of the response to the ED. That's fairly clear. So that'll be unlocked. Then you've got a risk margin, which you have to hold, and hence, effectively, that part sits separately, and that goes into your liability adequacy test too, so that you get loss recognition earlier. The key thing that coming out of this is effectively insurance liability really, as the top line says, is a future coverage liability and an incurred claims liability. And the two pieces really are fairly well now separate, and you really should think about them that way. And the key outcoming of that effectively is that, okay, your incurred claim liability, and what happens in that space, this comes straight to your P&L now. So effectively, IBNR assumption changes, no way you can offset them against future profit margins on your future biz book premiums. Any changes to termination assumptions for IP, they just hit your that number. And effectively, that's going to become quite a lot more volatile than it probably is for long-term tail business under MOS and that piece of there. And that part there, the incurred claim liability, as you can actually see from the slide, is effectively the same whether you're under simplified approach or building block. It's the same measurement under both. It's really a GI-style accounting measurement. Whereas the building block approach piece, what you've got left is your future coverage liability, which is now, like MOS, it's got a contractual service margin, a risk margin, and it's about the future coverage, the margins in that future book going forward, and the profit margin is expected to emerge out of that. And that looks like MOS, and your incurred liability piece just sits off to one side and now occurs what's coming through. And you can still get loss recognition under both, the building block and under the incurred claims under the simplified. The good thing with the simplified is clearly your contract boundary is only out to your next renewal, so you can't have too big a loss recognition hit. And if you get any nasty things going on, your incurred claims, well, you get that happening under both immediately anyway. It's not a loss recognition issue. So now, basically, I hand over to Brendan, who's basically going to talk us through the numerical examples.
Thanks, Grant. So I'm going to talk through some numerical examples for a lump sum term insurance policy. So we've got the assumptions up there. Effectively, it's a 20-year step premium yearly renewable term policy. We've made some assumptions about incremental acquisition expenses and non-incremental acquisition expenses. So we can see that coming through in the graphs that follow. And what I'll do first is show a single policy, what the profit expected profit pattern looks like for that, and then we'll look at what happens with a portfolio of policies and when you start to change some of these assumptions, particularly the new business growth rate assumption. So this is a single policy, what it would look like under the three methods. So you can see the blue line there, margin on services, with a 10% profit margin, acquisition costs fully deferred, so you've got no strain at the front end there. The red line is the IFRS simplified approach, so that will be a short duration contract
where we've assumed effectively all acquisition costs are not able to be deferred, although as Grant said you could if you wanted to defer them for 1 year. So you've got a large profit strain there at inception. Then the green line there is if you've got a longer term contract, so that might be a level term policy, for example, but still with high upfront acquisition costs, you are unable to defer the non-incremental or the overhead part of those costs, but you can still defer the rest. So you get some strain at the start compared to MOZ, but not quite as significant as under the short duration contract. So then what we've done is we've put together a portfolio of contracts, and with the growth rate of 10% and looking at the profit for the whole office under the three approaches. So you can see there margin on services is a better outcome for these particular assumptions, new business growth rates that we've assumed. The IFRS building block approach, slightly lower because we can defer less acquisition costs and we're still writing new business. And then the IFRS simplified approach, we've got a large strain up front and it takes a long time before we get into a profitable position. So this is assuming that effectively the life office starts up at the transition date. We'll have a look at an established life office versus a new life office in a sec, but effectively that's saying you've got nothing at the transition date and we're writing policies from that point onward. So the first example here where we've varied one of the assumptions is the new business. So what happens when we stop writing new business? At year 10 in this case, and you can see there, of course, at year 10, all of a sudden we've got no significant acquisition costs, so we get a large spike there and then the portfolio runs off. Similarly for the IFRS building block approach, long duration contracts, same again, although the spike's just not quite as large because we're still able to defer those incremental acquisition costs, and margin on services just starts to run off straight away when we stop writing new business. The next couple of slides, we're going to have a look at the new business growth rate. So I guess, fairly obvious, I guess, that one of the key drivers of this is how quickly you're writing new business if you can no longer defer your acquisition costs. So this one here is a high new business growth rate. And as you can see, we've got IFRS, the simplified approach down the bottom, and it never catches up because margin on services, we're simply deferring and deferring all our acquisition costs into the future, whereas with the simplified approach, we've got to take the hit up front. Then we've got a low new business growth rate. Starts to get a little bit more interesting, where we still have a significant strain up front for IFRS, but we do eventually catch up because we've put in place, by about year 15, we've got a large enough back book that our acquisition cost, the amortization cost under MOZ is actually going to be higher than the profits that you're getting from that back book for which you've deferred already and taken the hit for those acquisition costs under the simplified approach. So now a couple of final examples for the term business just before we look at the, I'll hand over to Waha to look at the IP, which is the established life office versus, I guess, a newer life office. So as Grant mentioned, one of the things that you'll be able to do on transition is if you've got a large deferred acquisition cost asset on your balance sheet, that'll effectively get written off through to retained earnings, and the future amortization of that cost you'll no longer incur under the IFRS approach. So this graph illustrates that. So if you're an established life office, depending on where you're sitting, how much new business you're writing, you might see that the IFRS simplified approach actually gives you a better outcome. So you're getting that tailwind, if you like, from the transition. No more DAC on your balance sheet, whereas under MOZ you're still amortising that DAC. And not surprisingly, the opposite occurs for a newer life office or an office which doesn't have such a large balance of DAC at the transition date and therefore can't take the benefit of writing off that DAC at the transition date, or doesn't get as much benefit for that. So here you can see we've got the numbers down there on the side, but effectively the new business that this particular office is writing is a higher proportion compared to the in-force book. So the new business strain is more significant than any benefit they're getting from writing off their smaller DAC at the transition date. So I guess I might just pause there for a second because just make a couple of comments on industry response, because it's something that comes up a fair bit, I think. I guess my key observation is that I don't think there is one size fits all response if this is an issue for your particular company, for the industry as a whole. So an established life office, you're going to have potentially higher profits under the new IFRS as you write off your DAC. And so that pretty good thing. You'll have less balance sheet volatility from the interest rates as well. So what's your response? Well, you might choose to do nothing. However, if you're a newer life office or if you've got higher new business growth, then potentially you're under more pressure to make some changes. I guess, what are the changes that you could make? Well, there's probably three that you could look at. One is that you could guarantee your premium rates on your stepped term for a period of time, effectively extending the contract boundary period if you wanted to defer your acquisition costs over a longer period. Second one is you could move to more level term type products, which will still be classed as long duration under the new standard. Or finally, you could try and have a look at changing the commission structures to a more level, less focus on upfront commission. And I guess, in my view, because there's going to be different companies in different situations, it's hard for me to see how, particularly that last one, changing commission structures is really going to come about just from this standard, because some companies are going to be under more pressure than others to change. So there's going to be that first mover disadvantage. If you're established life office, why would you follow? I'll hand over to Hua now, and she will talk about the income protection modelling.
Thank you, Brendan. What I'd like to do is two things. I want to take you through the issues that are relevant for income protection that are probably not apparent in the term insurance example. Then I want to take you quickly through what it means for group risk, and then the summary of the issues. So in the income protection example, basically the same principle. I've chosen the assumption so that the profit margin is the same as the term insurance. Now, those of you who are practitioners might think that's very optimistic, but that's what That's what the example is. It's a theoretical example. To do that, I had to increase the incremental and also the non-incremental expenses so that the percentage of them is the same. So you get the same picture at the end if nothing was changed, basically. And also I had to make an assumption on what risk margin you might want to hold. So in this example, the risk margin for future claims is greater than the risk margin for open claims, which is kind of makes sense because one covers both incidents and termination. The other one only covers termination risk. Let me explain the graph. So the columns, the red and green columns, are what the profit signature is for a single policy. If you had premium as a carrier, that's the red column, and the green is the claim as a profit carrier. So that's just saying what you already know, which is that if you have profit as a premium as a carrier, then it comes out pretty early and it's fairly even. Now, the big shaded blue area is what happened to your profit if you have the simplified approach, and the red line is if you have the building block approach. Okay. So that tells you, I guess, very similar picture to the term insurance example, except that the profit under the simplified approach under IFRS, which is the line, is very similar to the premium carrier MOS method, except for the first year. So it sits in between. It's like it sits in between the two MOS current method. Now, what happened if you changed your termination rates, which has kind of happened quite frequently recently? So this example is kind of chosen. It's a little bit extreme because it's saying in that year, what you do is you change your assumption enough so that you wipe out the profit margin under the claims carrier method. But under the other method, you'll see that because under the premium carrier method, you've got less profit left, so you would have, for the same change in termination rate, have a profit hit. And under the IFRS simplified approach, you only have to take 1 year's worth of hit. You don't have to take future hit. You only have to take the hit relating to your CICP, your past claims, and under the building block approach, you have to take the hit plus the loss recognition for future years. Right. So that's the picture there. And in the change of discount rate, it is very similar under three. So the picture is very similar. The impact on the CICP and IBNR is exaggerated. You could see very clearly in the graph. Now, what happened to group risk? Now, at the moment, it depends on what you're currently doing. If you're doing accumulation method and you don't defer any DAC, then theoretically the calculation is very similar, except that you have to hold a risk margin. But for most companies, if you measure risk right, the risk margin on top of a big IBNR and CICP reserve is actually quite a big number. So hence my comment, how much it impacts you depends on how big your IBNR is at the moment and how much is your view of the risk margin and the uncertainty around it, which if you look at the program for this conference, clearly suggests that it should be a very big number. If you had a projection, then the answer is very similar to what you've already seen, which is you have lower DAC or hardly any DAC, and you have total risk margin, and you can no longer spread the change in IBNR and CICP through your future, which is also apparent in the other examples. So theoretically, it shouldn't impact group risk as much, but in practice, I think it might impact group risk quite a bit in terms of the magnitude of the number. So to summarise, what are the key considerations? You'll have lower DAC, which means new business strain will become important and very apparent to the investors' community. you should expect more profit volatility because of the separation between past and future, which is also, those of you who have to report on US GAAP and Australian MOS will know that in US GAAP you've had to live with this for a long time, and it is a feature of the new IFRS standard as well. So change discount rate, change of assumption, and risk margin all go through to profit and loss. So you have one less lever for your profit, but you have one extra lever which is very ineffective at the moment, but very effective in the new world, and that's your new business growth and how much you pay for things up front. And the impact on transition will, of course, be very different. And so a key question, I think, is for business to understand this impact and to ask the question, do I want to have long-term contract or do I want to have short-term contract? And what it means for you is that your lever will be very different. Your capital cost might be quite different if you achieve the long-term label by having guarantee period, or you might have to change the way that your distribution force sell your business by going to level premium. So it has some real product design and distribution implication for you, as well as obviously profit emergence. So with that, I ask Grant to come and close.
Okay, we do want to give you time to ask questions rather than just listen to us, so we'll keep moving. Basically, the investor's perspective, as we mentioned here, is effectively fairly, what does this all actually mean? Well, clearly acquisition costs are fairly big, and so that's going to be fairly apparent, your acquisition strain. It's not just a capital issue, it's now really a profit issue if you're growing strongly, so clearly, I think investors are going to be fairly interested in convincing themselves that you actually are writing business in long-term profitable terms, whereas in the past you could defer it into the future and hope you didn't have a lapse problem when they eventually emerged. Another question is, effectively, is it going to mean established players are going to be valued more because the cost of growth is less of an issue? They've got a large book in the past. And you get more immediate signals on claim outcomes and changes to assumptions for claims. So effectively, it's already occurring with the problems around IP and the risk books anyway, but effectively, there's a lot of focus on people's ability to manage the claims, and that's going to come straight to your P&L if that's not happening well. And the other interesting thing I think is likely to be sitting there effectively is you're likely, almost certainly going to be up reporting your IP books, going to have effectively claim development triangles sitting in your disclosure notes, just like GI do, I would say. So there's going to be a lot more information sitting there around that book as well, I would say, for people to actually ask interesting questions from the investor's perspective. They're going to get more muted signals around lapses and your ability to use repricing to offset changes to your termination rates on your outstanding claims liability. Incurred claims liability is now gone. It helps for the margins if you've got a problem with your future profitability, but hopefully you're not running your future book and going forward on the basis that it is loss-making. So, and investors, basically, they're going to be interested on your view of what's behind your risk margins and how you're setting that and what signals they should be taking about the level of risk that you've got in your books, I would suspect. So there may be a number of interesting conversations coming up once people get their heads around it all. For management, if you're wanting to actually get to your profit target for the year, you've got about two or three levers. The hard one is your claims and outstanding claim assumption. I think that's a challenging one to manage to an outcome for the year. No matter how well, just some other conversation mentioned that your CFO comes down and sees your actuary regularly, but I don't know how that will work. The other one, which is an much easier one to actually manage, which may lead to a change, notwithstanding Brendan's comments and the dynamics, is if you're up against a wall, the immediate lever you can do is if you do something about your acquisition costs, that's it, comes straight through your profit this year. It's no longer being deferred. And so that may begin to look quite a lot more attractive from that perspective, particularly if you're under strain from profit from other angles. It's a challenging one to handle. And then growth rates. And they're basically the same, but less claims are still the same issue under both, as we said. And your acquisition cost expenses are more muted. Other considerations, briefly, tax is an interesting one. You've got no idea where the ATO is going to go when this all changes. But effectively, one nasty possibility hiding out might be there, that if the DAC disappears through a write-off on transition and doesn't go through a P&L, then effectively the assumed tax that you got against that DAC which hasn't gone through your P&L mightn't actually ever come through as an acquisition expense recovery from the past. One possibility is they may go to a New Zealand approach and basically align acquisition cost treatments that are deductible up front, so effectively applying a GI perspective to the whole lot. But it's really a guess as to where that is. That's a big unknown if you're not sure what the DAC's going to transition treatment is going to be on tax as to whether you want to go short term or not. So conclusion is it more useful? Well, my thoughts are, for investors, I think it is. Certainly the past and the future is much more clearly delineated, so they're not messed up from one another, so you can get a better understanding of what's occurring. The signals are generally more immediate. And the focus on claim performance is probably being heightened anyway, so I'm not sure but certainly that helps in that space as well. For management, I think it's easier probably to explain to management. Certainly when I was building the models behind all those lovely graphs, I found the GI and the simplified approach an awful lot easier to model, especially when you're trying to model changes as well on top of a standard model than MOS is, and to understand what's there. And you saw in the sense of the MOS, the IP, the difference between how it reacts under using premiums as a carrier or claims as a carrier, how different that beast is underneath the hood when you actually look at it. And then basically, what are you going to do? I guess companies got to think through what is their position, what they think is optimal, what they think their risk. And the other thing you've got is, this is coming in 2018, but your product decisions and your pricing decisions, like in other forums, whether you want to go towards, move your business towards level versus stepped, well, that's all going to influence the type of accounting you're going to have when this comes in. And so the decisions you're making now are actually effectively already driving the outcomes you're going to see once IFRS comes in. And you may want to have a view as to whether that's going to now influence your wider strategic thinking as well. Anyway, we'll now open it up for discussion.
Yeah, so if you've got to, please,
if you just go to the microphone and say your name. John Smith. I'd just like to ask a question. What's the impact on solvency? If we write off our DAC, then our actual solvency capital is going to reduce. Our minimum solvency capital is going to be the same. There's going to be a big solvency squeeze.
I don't believe that's the case. I know that was a big question we had way back when we did the original conversion ourselves into IFRS on the previous one on the wealth management business, your large DAC write-off. Everybody said, well, what's that going to do your solvency position? We said, well, the reason why you've got a large capital requirement is because you've got a DAC, and basically the regulators say that's a nice future asset, but it's intangible and it gets written off. So effectively, it didn't actually have an impact. Effectively, you're funding that capital anyway. That's what a large chunk of the alleged capital comes about, is effectively to cover that DAC. It's sitting there anyway. It's not going to change.
Yeah. I think the one thing it will do is...
I think the one thing it will do is your distributable profits will be closer to the operating profits, just because you've... you haven't got the capital locked up in the same way that you do under MOS.
Okay, thanks, Michael. Thanks, Grant. Thanks, Brendan. Thanks, Hoa. That's been very useful. I think one of your phrases you used to use, Grant, was unscramble the egg. And I think this has certainly, for me, unscrambled the egg with regard to the IFRS reported profit. Mark Henderson, my name. I work in the Zurich regional office in Hong Kong, so of interest to us is not just the reported profit, but cash as well. I mean, we'll manage the businesses in the region on an operating profit basis, but also on a cash basis. And I think further to the earlier question, what I'm really interested in is cash. And it comes back to that question of DAC. You write off this DAC. You've set this DAC up in the past, and you've paid tax at 30% on it. Will the ATO give you that 30% tax back when you write the DAC off? And if you get that, that's going to improve your solvency position. And we've got substantial balances of DAC on our balance sheets. So there's big numbers involved. Welcome your views on the timing of that and decision making as well. Thank you.
Really, as I said, that's a really hard one to guess where they're going. I mean, I know a number of years we actually had the ATO turn up at a Institute Insight session to understand what IFRS was doing, but I haven't been involved in any conversations or anybody in that space. I don't think they're actually, they won't be thinking about this until it actually comes out and they've got really hard facts to work with.
I don't think ATO is going to take it on unless we put it on their radar that we... It's very hard for us to put it on their radar until the standard is finalised. And I think that's one initiative that the industry should take, to actually take it to the ATO and say, now the world of reporting has changed, this is what's going to happen, we want you to support us. Well, that's how it should go, but it's very hard to go to the ATO on a ED that is, you know, has been in development for 15 years, but I take your point absolutely.
Yeah, it's Matthew Wood, also Zurich, but in the Australian office. So my fundamental thing on this is around the acceptance around the boundary condition rules.
Mm-hmm.
To me, the wording is quite grey in the standard. And you talk about if the premium's a guarantee, then that gives you the boundary condition out to the end of the guarantee. You talk about level premium business, which is the end of when the level finishes for most people's age 65. And I think the wording of the standard talks about if you're repricing, takes into account all future years, then that extends the boundary condition. But surely for step premium business, when you reprice, you're not repricing just the 1 year. You're repricing a whole rate table, a whole series of rates up to about, you know, age 99. So why can't that also be have the extended boundary condition?
I think it goes back to whether you can effectively fully reprice your portfolio at the renewal. And the word is effectively, it's not, you know, at an individual contract level. And so long as you can basically reset your pricing, sort of usual market forces, etc., then that effectively defines the boundary. You've got a whole set of rates, I agree, for all the ages, but that's the same regardless of GI. I mean, the rate, for, or even a GI contract, when I renew it each year, it changes with all the rating factors and all the other stuff. It's more individually rated, but it is that. And so I think, depending where you want to go, there'll be a lot of arguing around, can I manoeuvre myself across the boundary, but not too far across the boundary, because the flip side of all this is the more you argue that you've got really solid guarantees in there, there may be an interesting conversation going inside your logic number calculation as well.
Can I just follow on questions? Just clarification about level premium business.
Yeah.
Level premium rates are not guaranteed in this country.
Yeah.
And that a company can effectively reprice the level premium business every single year. How does it affect, just for clarification about the boundary, if you're going to reprice your level premium contract every year to whatever you believe you can get away with,
yep,
does that push out the boundary, or is it effectively a one-year contract?
Basically, on the level premium, there's a little other little rider on that, effectively. It's to do with, effectively, whether or not the premiums you're charging, collecting in a particular year up to the repricing event, purely relate to risks up to that repricing event, whether or not they've got an element of funding for future risks. And if you've got a level premium by implication, unless you believe mortality is flat with age, there is clearly a level of funding for future mortality increases and increased level of risk over the contract. And that's what gets level premium effectively into the long-term boundary, even if you can fully reprice.
If you look at paragraph 23B2, it talks about that very explicitly. It talks about the price of it extending beyond. And it clearly describes the cases where you have level premium, and so your premium is covering some risks that are outside of the next year, and so it gets you out of jail.
It's Richard Land. I'd like to make another comment on the contract boundary. So in the presentation, there's been a lot of thought about extending the contract boundary over 1 year so that you can use the building rock approach rather than the simplified approach, and therefore achieve slightly higher profits under that way in a growing portfolio. I think there's also some arguments for the other way, because the other way is just is pretty much the P&L looks like premiums, less claims, less expenses, and pretty much on a cash basis you've got your liabilities as your own premium. It's incredibly simple, and the implementation costs are very low, and the ongoing ones are as well, as opposed to some unresolved issues on the building block approach where you've got tranching and all sorts of bucketing of results. So I think there may be some arguments for going the other way and also using maybe embedded value a little bit more to explain your results. So that's maybe just one thought. I'm not sure if you have any comments on that.
I'll start. I think the simplicity of it, I absolutely agree with you. I think thinking about it commercially, though, it is a lot harder always to tell your shareholders to take a hit, a very, very large hit, which is equal to or even greater than your first year's premium in the year that you write it. So it's balancing between your ability to persuade your shareholders to continue to put in the capital into a business that will not show profit for some time. But yeah, in terms of the elegance of the outworking of it, I absolutely agree with you. We're not advocating either approaches. I think we could see a lot of simplicity in the new IFRS simplified approach world, but I could also see an argument for going the other way.
Yes, I agree. There's arguments about that.
Yeah, I think, Richard, particularly the point's been made around a fast-growing new entrant having to report, you know, heavy losses for a significant period of time, which doesn't necessarily reflect the economics of what they're doing.
Mm. Yeah, the other side of it is if you're a nice, stable entrant with a very large DAC that you now write off, so, OK, you're effectively your capital base has come down, your equity's come down, so your ROE's gone up. You're also getting better profit margins because you've no longer got that DAC charge coming through, so you're looking much more attractive. And okay, if you're still growing strongly, you've got an acquisition strain, but if you start managing, taking action to manage that acquisition strain cost down on your new contracts as opposed to renewing contracts and rebalance that, you're going to look very attractive compared with other people, and it's going to be quite an interesting dynamic playing out.
Can I just ask one more, add one more thing to Richard's question? One thing that I think I don't like about the new world, even if you put aside the shareholders' concern about deferring profit, in the IFRS simplified approach, you don't give any prominence to the lapse issue, and yet we know it does impact profit for real, and it doesn't give a very good picture of what does your retention look like and what does your next year profit look like. It gives you no hint of that, and I think that's, for me, that's one of the major shortfall of using the simplified approach for a YRT contract like we see it written in Australia. Right? That would be my key concern with that message. It has lots of other good things. It gives much better management information on the current year, but it doesn't tell you anything about next year. And that, to me, is very immediate. Like, that's pretty relevant.
Yes, that's why I think you need to use embedded value in conjunction with it if you're going to go the simplified approach. I just had another comment or question about the rate guarantee. So in relation to group business, I know you showed it as a simplified approach, but now we're sort of swapping, well, in this case, from three-year guarantees to one-year guarantees. And as that goes, flips across the test for the contract boundary, which is 1 year, in my mind, that meant that you would need to go from the building block approach to the simplified approach. Is that correct or not?
You could always use the building block approach if you want to.
Yeah, I think the simplified approach can be used much the same way as under margin on services currently, where it's effectively an approximation to the building block approach. So I don't think it's a hard and fast one-year boundary, and you should still be able to use the simplified approach, even if it was, say, a three-year pricing, repricing period.
Fred Jorgensen. Richard touched on one issue that I'd be interested in comments on, which is the tranching issue. And I'm interested both in the simplified approach and the building block approach, and so I'd be interested in any comments you have, both in respect of the future risk liability and the claims liability.
I think the one beauty is the simplified approach. If you get it all as short term, then effectively it is all one tranche. So that neatly sidesteps that problem. Well, if you're simplified and you're in 1 year, if you're a short-term boundary, effectively you're only going out 1 year, so you haven't got any future beyond the next renewal, like a GI company. So you don't have a tranching problem. The tranching problem is there, particularly around if you're doing OCI, etc. And I'm not quite clear where the ISB is going to land, apart from the fact that they clearly accepted that, given all the feedback, OCI has to be at least optional. And they're working through ultimately how they're going to play that out.
Probably time for one last question. Anyone's got one? Otherwise, no, Lucky. Thanks, John.
John Nichols might ask a question on a slightly different topic around IFRS 9. Currently for asset measurement in Australia, we're basically restricted to effectively like a fair value option. Do you see that potentially changing with IFRS 9 and potentially available for sale type approaches becoming on the asset side? I guess the related question is implications for that around need for tranching. Part of that might be for separating some of the impacts between the P&L and OCI, for example.
I guess if the ISB continues on its current path, which is to make OCI optional, albeit there's probably going to be a fair bit of disclosure, which means we have to do all the tranching anyway, you would... notwithstanding that disclosure, you would probably want to continue on the liability side, at least in the same way we're doing it under margin on services, not having the OCI effectively. In which case, I guess IFRS 9, you would take the approach under IFRS 9 that best matches that, which is what we're currently doing. If you did want to use OCI, then sure, you could look at changing the asset valuations under IFRS 9 as well. The approach that you do there, you will be able to do that at the transition date. But I guess, hard to see that any companies would go down that path.
It's hard to see that APRA will let you use anything but fair value.
Okay, we might wind the session up there. So thanks very much for your petition. I think it was a really great discussion and great comments and questions. Would you please join me in thanking Hua, Brendan and Grant for a session? Thank you.